This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Tim Curry became a star and was typecast for decades when he reprised his British stage role of sweet transvestite Frankenfurter in the 1975 cult film musical The Rocky Horror Picture Show. 30 years later, he's back on stage, this time on Broadway, in a role and play inspired by a film. The film is Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and the musical, Spamalot, is the big hit of the Broadway season and a frontrunner at Sunday's Tony Awards. Tim Curry isn't just in Spamalot, he's at its center as the grail-seeking King Arthur.
I am Arthur, King of the Britons, and we are seeking men who are able. And so we're recruiting Dennis to sit at our very, very, very round table. Ready!
Who's the king?
You are!
Who's the king?
You are! A-R-T-H-U-R-I-T-H-E-R!
Spamalot is written by Monty Python member Eric Idle and directed by Mike Nichols. In addition to Tim Curry, Spamalot features Hank Azaria, from whom we'll hear in the second half of the show, as well as David Hyde Pierce and Sarah Ramirez. Terry spoke to Tim Curry in March when Spamalot was about to open. She asked him how he got involved with the show.
I've known Eric Idle a long time, one of the original Pythons, and he now lives in Los Angeles, as do I. And so we see each other quite a bit. And in fact, the summer before last, we were hoping to do a film together, which he had written and was going to direct, which was a kind of demolition of every Miramax movie ever made, called The Remains of the Piano. And that never quite happened because the money... It's a good title, isn't
very
it?
Very good, very good.
I was going to play the Reverend Whoopsie. And Robin Williams was going to play Vanessa Redgrave in Howard's End. I loved his lines, which were stuff like, You, I haven't met you before. You shall have the teacup when I go. No, you shall have the grand piano. Oh, no... No, you shall have the house. So that never happened, but he said, I think it looks like we are finally going to get to do the musical version of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and we're going to call it Spamalot. And first of all, I thought that was just terribly funny. But I also thought, oh, well, you know, I'll believe it when it happens. And then suddenly Mike Nichols was directing it, and they put David Hyde Pierce and Hank Azaria and I and a couple of other people on a plane from California, and we came into New York and we sat down and read it with a bunch of other people from New York, some of whom are in the play. And it just went like gangbusters, and I guess the next day I was going to be King Arthur.
So Spamalot incorporates some classic Monty Python bits in it. That I assume a lot of people in the audience probably know by heart. What kind of response do you get when you get to the classic parts?
It's quite interesting because the audience always sort of contains some core of Monty Python fans who see stuff coming, you know, and react with great whoops of joy. And then settle down to see it unfold. I mean, they're hugely welcoming, and then they really want to see it happen. I mean, happily, they're not talking along with it, because that would, you know, that would need a spanking. But but they love it, and they see it coming, and they are thrilled to see characters and sketches that they recognize.
You knew the Monty Python material, and the audience
yes.
knows a lot of the Monty Python material. But
yes.
do you know a lot of the early Nichols and May sketches?
I do. I was always a fan, and so it was sort of very interesting for me to work with him. And he has a first of all, every note that you ever get from Mike is preceded by "That was wonderful." That was wonderful. One small thing. So you're given this enormous sort of sense of entitlement, and then something tiny and completely accurate is lodged like a little sort of Navajo arrow in your brain. And what his great note, I think, because I was playing it pretty broadly at the beginning, because so much of it is like something that we in England called pantomime and sort of is part of vaudeville, really. And his first note and recurring note to me is, yes, that's great. It's, you know, it's very funny. Now let's make it true. And I think that's his great gift to this material, is that he's given it a great big sort of beating Arthurian heart. And that's an extra dimension that you just sort of don't expect. And of course also makes it so much more interesting to play.
We're listening back to an interview Terry Gross recorded earlier this year with actor Tim Curry. Curry became famous for his starring role in the 1975 cult classic The Rocky Horror Picture Show as Dr. Frankenfurter, the sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania. Here he is welcoming two naive strangers, Brad and Janet, played by Barry Bostwick and Susan Sarandon, to his isolated estate.
Magenta. Columbia. Go and assist Riff Raff. I will entertain...
Brad Majors. This is my fiancée, Janet Weiss.
Weiss?
Enchanté. Well, nice. And what charming underclothes you both have. But here, put these on. They'll make you feel less vulnerable. It's not often we receive visitors here, let alone offer them hospitality.
Hospitality? All we wanted to do was to use your telephone. Damn it, a reasonable request, which you've chosen to ignore.
Dad, don't be ungrateful.
Ungrateful?
How forceful you are, Brad. Such a perfect specimen of manhood. So dominant.
You know, like so many other of your fans, I first saw you in the Rocky Horror Picture Show in the 70s. And when you see somebody in a movie for the first time, it's sometimes hard to tell how good they are. You don't know... Is this all they can do? Do they do other things too? Is this what they're really like? Or, you know, how much are they acting? And so I saw you, I guess it was probably like the late 80s, in Wise Guy, the TV series.
Yes.
And you played a kind of Phil Spector-ish, brilliant but crazy record producer.
That's right.
And a great, really terrific performance. And that's, I think, is when I really got the picture. Wow, he's really good at doing all kinds of things.
So. That's so nice. I mean, it's sort of important for me because, you know, that first performance that sort of introduced me to everybody was so out there and so...
I'll say, yeah.
So kind of outrageous that, you know, I was a very quiet boy for a while, you know, just to make sure that people got it, that, you know, that wasn't necessarily who I was.
Was that because
it was my first movie, you know?
That was your first movie?
Yeah.
How did you get the part?
I got the part because I used to work a great deal at a theatre in London called the Royal Court. And I guess they have a little theatre upstairs which seats about 60 people, and I did Brecht there and... I did a sort of Rudyard Kipling show there, and I guess the next show, I did a dreadful musical, a Marxist musical called Give the Gaffers Time to Love You, with a director who kept saying, Barry, the second act just simply isn't Marxist enough. And that, of course, never even opened to the critics, but the next show coming in was this other musical called The Rocky Horror Show. And originally I played Frankenfurter as though he was German. It was Dr. Frankenfurter, and everything was very interesting and stupid. And then one day I heard a woman on a bus saying, "Do you have a house in town or a house in the country?" And I thought, yes, she should sound like the Queen. So
that's
he
great.
Should sound like the Queen. So, but that's how it happened, and it just started in this tiny theatre, you know, and it just took off like a sort of rocket.
Did you like the kind of cheap horror films that it in part parodied?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it. Richard's brilliance really was just, you know, it was really like reaching up a hand into the zeitgeist and just grabbing, you know, horror, 50s horror movies, Sandra Dee, mm-hmm. comic books, and 50s rock and roll, and just hurling them all together. With the, you know, some fishnet tights thrown in. And the fishnet tights really, you know, came from a brilliant costume designer called Sue Blaine, who I'd worked with before, actually, in a wonderful theatre in Scotland called the Glasgow Citizens Theatre, where we did a production of The Maids, where I wore exactly that corset.
The Jean Genet play?
Yeah, the Jean Genet play. I played Solange, and we bought the corset for £3 off a barrow in the market in Glasgow and wore it back to front.
That's funny, you'd be wearing it in for, like, this transgressive playwright, Genet, and then this kind of parody
absolutely.
Of everything, Rocky Horror.
Absolutely.
Well, there's probably nothing that can get you into character quickly, like black bikini briefs, fishnet stockings, the garter belt, the corset, the whole thing.
Well, absolutely. But that was a fairly late development. I mean, I had no idea it was going to be like that.
You until, didn't when you accepted the part?
No. I thought I'd be in a white lab coat, you know. And, I mean, the great gag about... you know, the way that we all looked was, and I've always said this to anybody who's ever asked me about playing Frankenfurter, if they were playing it, you know, to just never think about it as drag, because it's not. It's just what people wear in Transylvania. You know, it's just what everybody wears in Transylvania, so just get over it, you know. It's truck driver drag. It's not about going boop boop a doob. It's just what they happen to wear.
I think the thing I found most amazing about the whole phenomenon of Rocky Horror was watching, like, the 12-year-olds outside the theater parading around in their transvestite clothes. Because they were all, it was like all these 12-year-olds outside the theater imitating you in your getup. And you had to just kind of ask yourself, what is going on here? What do the 12-year-olds make of it? I mean, are they going through some kind of gender thing, or do they just love the movie? Like, what is this about?
I think it's all of the above. It's a kind of rite of passage now, I think. And actually, first of all, it's a guaranteed weekend party to which you can go with or without a date and probably find one if you don't have one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, I think, a chance for people to try on a few roles for size, you mm-hmm. know, figure out, help them maybe figure out their own sexuality. I mean, I think that's probably taking it a little deeper than it needs to go, but I think it has had a useful purpose in that way, and I've certainly had some very interesting and moving mail from people who have said, you know, thanks for helping me figure out who I was, you know, and that's very nice.
Your father was a chaplain in the British Navy.
Yes.
What did your parents think of your role in Rocky Horror?
Well, he, alas, was dead, because he died when I was 12.
Oh.
So he wasn't even aware that I was an actor, even. I think my mother... who, you know, is really like one of those sort of Monty Python ladies, you know. I can't imagine what's going on. you know, who always had a hat. And since my first job in the theatre was hair and, you know...
And you were probably naked in that, right?
And I did appear naked in it. I think, you know, it was a relief to her that I actually was wearing clothes of any kind. In,
at least
in
you were covered by a corset and garters.
She was happily unaware that that part of the character, particularly Frankenfurter at his most gracious, was based on her.
in what way?
Well, it was sort of her telephone voice, you know. Do you have any tattoos, Brad? My sister, when she saw it, fell on the floor and said, you know, does she know? And I said, no, she has absolutely no idea, and please don't tell her. She thought it was very, very amusing and brought all her friends. So she was pretty hip lady, my mother, and she got it. I mean, you know, astonishingly. She loved it.
Really
she didn't
funny.
Like it as much as the Pirates of Penzance, which I did at Drury Lane, because the Queen Mother came to that, and that, you know, was the total seal of approval of my career.
And I would bet that the Queen Mother did not go to Hair or Rocky Horror.
I don't think she went to either, although Princess Margaret did come to Rocky Horror and had a wonderful time.
Really?
And so did Princess Diana, actually requested to meet me because she was such a Rocky Horror fan.
So did you ever meet Princess Diana?
I did actually meet Princess Diana. I was doing a production of Love for Love, and it was taken to Vienna for British Week, and we played at the Burgtheater, and Prince Charles and Princess Diana were the guests of honour, and which was when she said that she very much wanted to meet me, and so they sort of put me at the end of the receiving line, and Prince Charles said, I think I've seen you on television. Haven't I seen you on television? I said, yes, sir, I'm sure you've seen me on television. Yes, I thought I'd seen you on television. But Diana said, you were in the Rocky Horror Show. And I said, yes, ma'am, I was. And I was, but I'm sure that you haven't seen it. She said, oh, yes, she said. It quite completed my education. She was a very funny girl, and a very beautiful one, and sort of a very wicked smile came with that sentence. She was great fun, the world is poorer without her.
You grew up in England. Your father was a chaplain in the Navy.
Yeah.
Were you religious when you were growing up?
Rather not. As preachers' kids tend not to be, you know. I mean, my father was pretty chill about all of that. I mean, he wasn't... Methodism in England is a lot more relaxed than it is in the States. It's not as forbidding or as chilly. And he was a very liberal and very funny man. But, you know, I did willy-nilly show up, you know, to Sunday school morning and afternoon and went to hear him preach when he was on shore, because he was quite often at sea. And I spent my childhood in sort of various sort of naval bases until he died when I was quite young, when I was 12. And we moved to South London, and I went to boarding school. And I actually went to a school that was founded by John Wesley, I mean, who founded Methodism in, you know, the school, I think, started in 1784 or something and was founded for the sons of Methodist ministers. So I went to a fairly kind of churchy school, which also turned out to be very kind of relaxed and liberal. And I was a cheerful agnostic, really, you know, from then on.
Still a cheerful agnostic?
Still a cheerful agnostic.
Did you have to go to church, and did you sing a lot in church?
Well, that was the great bonus, because the Methodist Church has a remarkable body of hymns, largely a great number of them by Charles Wesley. And so I sang in church from about, I don't know, six or seven, and I was a real boy soprano for, you know, until my voice changed.
It changed a lot, didn't it?
It did change quite a whole lot. I was very lucky because I had a great music teacher who sent away to Westminster Choral School for exercises when my voice started breaking. Because, you know, so often people with wonderful boy soprano voices end up with no mature singing voices at all. And I managed to make that transition happily. And it's funny, when I was doing... I don't know whether this is interesting. When we were doing Pirates of Penzance, I had my first singing lessons, really. the lady who was doing them said, you know, we must work on your falsetto and get your range up. And I said, I don't have a falsetto. And she said, oh, nonsense, everyone has a falsetto. And I said, no, I really don't. And she made me find one. And she suddenly had this revelation one day. And she said, were you a boy soprano? And I said, yes, I was. And she said, you're in mourning for that sound, aren't you? And I realized that I was. I mean, it is of great sadness not to be able to make that extraordinary pure sound that you do make as a boy soprano.
That's actually really interesting,
It is. It's fascinating, isn't it? I think I just, you know, cut off that alley.
But you kept singing, didn't you?
I kept singing, yes, absolutely.
So did you go to, like, the loud, gruff rock band kind of singing afterwards?
Well, no, actually, I mean, you know, at 17 or 18, I was singing leader and, you know, I was singing sort of classical music, really. But then, I guess, you know, the Beatles happened and it was all over.
So what kind
That and Marlboro, you know.
Marlboro cigarettes.
It's funny because I actually quit smoking a year ago and it was fascinating because within 3 weeks, my voice went back up a ten and a half, and I remembered, and I heard the voice that I remembered myself singing in when I was 19 or 20.
Huh.
It's very odd, and it's a great warning to anyone to stay away from the demon tobacco, stupid drug that it is.
No, I've read that you not only love Billie Holiday, but that you do Billie Holiday, and I wasn't sure whether that meant that you sing a lot of songs associated with her or whether you can do a good Billie Holiday impression.
Well, both, I hope. I don't know. I did a film for television in England called Blue Money where I played an impressionist. And I did a few singers, including Billie Holiday. Who else did I do? I did Ray Charles and I did Elvis and I don't know. Yes, I do Billie Holiday. Whether you would want to hear it now, I sort of doubt.
Well, but you'd be wrong because I'd love to hear it if you were game.
Them man's God shall give, them that's not shall lose. So them Bible says, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. Oh, it's much too early in the morning for that.
Did her singing influence you a lot? Even though
Hugely. I didn't listen to anybody else for about 2 years when I was 18. I was just, you know, this awful, depressive teenager listening to Billie Holiday and wondering, you know, which gloomy Sunday I was going to throw myself under a car.
Oh, yeah. Which
You know how
which,
it is.
Which period were you mostly listening to of her?
Mostly the really early stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I find the later stuff very...
Because you were singing in the later voice.
Very unhappy.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the voice you were
Well, I'm singing
there.
The later voice because, of course, I'm singing 8 times a week and
right.
I don't quite have the control over my voice that I do. Really, it doesn't actually sort of start to warm up until the evening. It's weird when you do a musical because you sing so hard and so regularly that your voice kind of goes into shock until it actually has to be produced for that evening.
Did you always know that you had that ability to mimic?
Yes, I think, you know, you have it or you don't. Hank Azaria, who's in this show, is an absolutely dazzling mimic and do anybody. You sort of have an ear or you don't, I think. And I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with... amusing other children when you're young and, you know, getting out of being hit.
Right. Is that effective for you?
I think it's effective for all childhood comedians. I think it's, you know, the root of a great deal of comedy.
Well, Tim Curry, I wish you really good luck with Spamalot.
Thank you so much for talking with us. My pleasure.
Tim Curry, speaking with Terry Gross in March. He's nominated for a Tony for Best Performance by a Leading Actor in a Musical for his role in Spamalot. The ceremony is Sunday night.